The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say to safety, he's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Aliza Levy, author of the Jewish Woman's Prayer Book. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish storyteller, Jordan Hill, and our expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our new contributor on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom and Lashana Tova. It's the Jewish New Year of 5771 now, a bright, shining new year filled with promise and potential. But it's also the most serious time of the year for us when we examine our conduct and seek to set a positive tone for the new year. This coming Friday night is the big night for Jews, the evening of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, holiest night of the year, prelude to the holiest day of the whole year. Yom Kippur is a fast day when adult Jews, those of us older than 13, neither eat food nor drink water, 24 hours in which we examine our souls and seek forgiveness for the wrongs of the past year. This is always a time of exaltation. That's why we call them the High Holy Days, but there is also a certain sense of pressure. We are in the heart of the 10 days of repentance now, the Aseret Yemei Tshuva, when we Jews try to right the wrongs we've done in the past year and reconcile with anyone we've injured or offended. It's a challenge to try to heal our actions from the last 12 months. It's perhaps a greater challenge to change the habits we've fallen into that lead us to do things we are not proud of. Our goal during these days of awe is to look honestly at ourselves, to ask God to forgive the failings we've committed in the last year, and so allow us to become whole again. But as the Talmud tells us, for sins against God, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, atones. But for sins against other human beings, the Day of Atonement does not atone, until we have made atonement to them personally. God cannot heal the breaches in our relationships. Only we can do that, by going to the people we've wronged and asking them to forgive us. This is the most important time for us morally, a crucial period of reflection, self-examination, and what in Israel they call cheshbon ha-nefesh, taking an account of our souls. On Yom Kippur, the fast day of atonement, this holiest day, which begins at sundown Friday, we commit ourselves to repair our world through repentance, prayer, and charity, teshuvah, tefillah, utzidakah. The melody that captures the essence of Yom Kippur is the only melody that people come to temple just to hear, the Kol Nidre, the renunciation of failed vows that begins the night of Yom Kippur. It's a melody that captures the heart of the Jewish experience in just a few minutes of music. Here's the great cantor Alberto Mizrahi's rendition of the first part of Kol Nidre.
Vachinoyei, vachinoyei,
That was most of the Kol Nidre, sung by cantor Alberto Mizrahi, an arrangement by Sholem Secunda. Kol Nidre is designed to bring us close to what is holiest within us. And at this time of atonement and return, we do well to remember as well that holiness begins, for Jews, with personal actions, mitzvot, not just words or professions of faith. The way to improve the world is by doing good, not by talking about it. That's what we dedicate ourselves to this week, actions that matter and improve the world. Nonetheless, we need God's help. That's never more clear than in the Kol Nidre's soaring conclusion. Here's Israeli cantor and Broadway star David Fisher's version of it from the end of the Kol Nidre. You know, I could do a whole show on the melody of Kol Nidre, its many interpretations, stories about Kol Nidre, jokes about Kol Nidre, and so on. But the truth is, the only way to appreciate Kol Nidre is to hear it live, in the synagogue Friday night, on the eve of Yom Kippur, in a room filled with fervent prayer, soaring music, and the power of the Day of Atonement. It's truly an amazing experience, and it takes place just one night a year. But I would be remiss as a radio show host if I didn't give you a little bit of Kol Nidre shtick. It's not only great cantors who have recorded this amazing melody. In fact, a couple of non-Jews have tried their vocal cords on Kol Nidre. Here is Perry Como crooning Kol Nidre. And then there is my favorite bad Kol Nidre, Johnny Mathis of Chances Are fame, warbling Kol Nidre, you know, sorta. For my money, is the worst Kol Nidre I have heard. Although there is a competitor, and he's Jewish. Neil Diamond sang Kol Nidre in the movie version of The Jazz Singer. Eesh, here it is. Kol Nidre Vesore Acharome Vekonome Vachino ye, vachino se. That was Neil Diamond's Kol Nidre on the Rocks. No surprise. Or maybe it was Kol Nidre on the Ropes. Well, when chanted well, the melody of Kol Nidre brings us to tshuva and helps us learn to work to heal injustice and brokenness in our lives and in the world. This Friday, sundown, if you haven't made arrangements, go to your nearest synagogue immediately. It's a night you don't want to miss. You also won't want to miss our guest this morning, Aliza Lavie, who collected women's prayers throughout history and throughout the world and has created a new book that has become an unexpected bestseller. Find out why when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. Sometimes I think my brother Vinny and I are the luckiest guys in the whole wide world. You see, to us, Mama's is more than just a restaurant. It's a connection to our past. Back in New York, food was the center of our lives. Our family got together for almost any reason to enjoy the great Italian dishes our mom used to make. The scent of slow-cooking marinara. The distinct aroma of garlic simmering in olive oil, pasta boiling on the stove. These are memories that remind me of family, friends, home. Our goal at Mama's is to serve more than just delicious Italian food. Sure, our pizza and calzones are outstanding. Our cheesecake is to die for. But we strive to serve you more. Call it atmosphere or mood. Or you can just call it love. We hope the next time you come into one of Mama's four locations, it'll become one of your pleasant memories. To Vinny and me, that's the measure of our success. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
We're delighted to welcome the Too Jewish this morning, Dr. Aliza Lavie, the editor, author of A Jewish Woman's Prayer Book. She's a lecturer in the Department of Political Studies at Bar-Ilan University. In addition to her academic activity, she's a writer, publicist, media personality, and social activist. Her public activities, as you might expect, focus on gender and Jewish culture. She is one of the foremost personalities in Israel concerning the cultural Jewish sphere. Good morning, Boker Tov.
Good morning.
Thank you for speaking to us from Israel. You are the author of A Jewish Woman's Prayer Book, Tfilat Nashim, which won the 2008 National Jewish Book Award. It's a bestseller. What prompted you to create Tfilat Nashim?
First of all, you know, I'm a Jewish woman. I live here in Israel. I'm a mother. I was an officer in the army. I'm a social activist. And, you know, sometimes in life you can't find answers, especially answers when you want to find yourself in your religion and you find your identity. And more ask, I understood that I don't have enough knowledge. And when I asked the spiritual leaders, the rabbi, I found that they don't understand me and my colleagues, my friends, either in the university or in our, you know, social activist forum. And I found that when you don't have answers in your life, you must go and find them. That's what I recommend to my students and my kids.
So in finding the answers, do you feel that you found them more in the depth and the sources of the prayers? Did you find them more in your encounter with the American cultural examination of the woman's role in prayer in the synagogue, which was more influential?
First of all, I found a lot of sensitive, especially from the rabbis and the spiritual leaders, and understanding of women's needs. You know, I mean, the things that women, when they came to the synagogue, when they came to the public square, they didn't know the language. and they couldn't pray. And I think that now I understand that no one can continue life without praying. Even people that say to you, oh, prayer is not for us, even here in Israel, you know, in some places, in the kibbutzim or other places, there is no even synagogue. But I found that everybody prays. And when I think about, you know, the women that in Morocco, in Afghanistan, in Spain, other countries and communities, when they didn't know how to pray in which language, they create for themselves, and some rabbis that were sensitive enough for women needs wrote prayers for them in their language, in Ladino, in German later, in Yiddish, in now in orders in English and in Spanish or Italian, etc., etc.
It is a remarkable collection, and we will discuss with Dr. Lisa Levy, her Jewish woman's prayer book, Tefillat Nashim, and many other topics when we return on To Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson, and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org.
Hi, I'm Rabbi Sam Kohan of Temple Emmanuel. My favorite High Holy Day quotation this year comes from that great font of Jewish knowledge, Charles Schulz's cartoon Peanuts. Charlie Brown, the everyman Nebish, says, "Sometimes I lie awake at night and ask, where have I gone wrong? And then a voice comes and says to me, this is going to take more than one night." You know, this time of year, we take a look at our lives and see what it is we really need, how we should be living. It's great to come to a temple and explore our Jewish heritage. Come, join us here at Temple Emmanuel as we start this process. Call 520-327-4501. Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. High Holy Days, Early Childhood Education Center, Religious School, Adult Education Academy. Call 327-4501. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at tojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at tojewishradio.com. You can get CDs of past and present shows through the website or downloading us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. You know, with Rosh Hashanah last week and lots more Jewish holidays coming up this week and next and the next, Yom Kippur is Friday and Saturday, then Sukkot a week from Wednesday and Thursday, then Hoshana Rabbah and Shemini Atzeret and Simchat Torah, an outpouring of fall festivals, I think it's time to explain a critical component of the Jewish holiday experience, our odd relationship to food on festivals. Now, as a general principle, Jewish holidays are divided between days on which we must starve and days on which we must overeat. Although most Reform and Conservative Jews are familiar with all the overeating holidays and fast only on Yom Kippur, Orthodox Jews may actually observe no fewer than 16 fasts throughout the Jewish year, based on the time-honored principle that even if you are sure you are ritually pure, you aren't. In any case, although there are many Jewish feasts and fasts, as far as I know, there are no holidays requiring light snacking. Now, unlike Christians who just go to church on special days, on Jewish holidays, most Jews take the whole day off. That's because Jews, for historical and personal reasons, are more stressed out. So anyway, here's your handy diet guide to the Jewish holidays, starting with Rosh Hashanah last week and going forward through the fall, winter, spring, and summer festivals, all categorized by their dietary requirements. Rosh Hashanah, feast, Tzom Gedalia, which is today, by the way, fast. Yom Kippur, more fasting. Sukkot, feast. Hoshana Rabbah, more feasting. Simchat Torah, keep feasting. The month of Cheshvan, no feasts or fast for a whole month. Get a grip on yourself. Hanukkah, eat potato latkes. Tenth of Tevet, fast. Do not eat potato latkes. Tu Bishvat, feast. Fast of Esther, fast. Purim, eat pastry. Passover, do not eat pastry. Shavuot, feast, but only on dairy foods like cheesecake or blintzes. 17th of Tammuz, fast. Definitely don't eat cheesecake or blintzes. Tisha B'Av, very strict fast. Don't even think about cheesecake or blintzes. The month of Elul, end of cycle. Enroll in Center for Eating Disorders before the High Holy Days arrive again. Well, I hope that's all clear now. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy, and Gmar Chatima Tova.
Boker Tov, Rabbi Cohen, Gmar Chatima Tova, and thank you for having me.
May you be sealed in the Book of Life for a good year. Yom Kippur is coming up this weekend, Friday night, Saturday. Time when we look inward. In Israel, they call it a cheshbon ha-nefesh, counting of the soul. Tell us a little bit about that process.
When we do a cheshbon nefesh, as individuals, and as groups, we look into ourselves. We kind of measure our deeds along the past year, thinking what we did good, what we did wrong, and we kind of hope to be signed in the Book of Life. Coming to speak on the Book of Life, we also remember in Israel the Yom Kippur War, in which Israel was threatened and actually was in a very high risk of not existing anymore after the war. Today, we're facing a kind of a same threat when Iran gains nuclear power. And in this Yom Kippur, from my perspective, we need to put thought on how can we stop such a country like Iran from gaining nuclear power. And do we, as human beings, want a dictator like Ahmadinejad to have control of such a power and such a weapon?
You know, the Yom Kippur War, 1973, it's 37 years ago this week. I remember well, you're too young, but I remember very well being in the synagogue and everybody going outside, and suddenly there was a war. You know, we heard about it, and the tremendous level of tension among the Jews, because it really was an existential threat. Israel could be destroyed in a few hours. Hasn't really faced existential threats in the same way in a long time. I mean, there have been a variety of wars in Lebanon and elsewhere, Gaza, but nothing really since then, which made you feel like Israel's existence could disappear. It seems to me that that's the number one issue for Israelis, is the question of Iran's nuclear capability. Is that still true, or is it more true now than before?
I think it becomes more and more true now than ever before, as Iran is very, very close to gaining this option. And from what I read in the press, I don't really think Israel alone has any option of stopping Iran from gaining this nuclear option and nuclear power. And we need to remember that Iran holds the most extremist Shia Islamic views, which are also a threat to all moderated Arab countries like Egypt, Jordan, Turk, and more.
So, well, we pray for some control and some resolution in this coming year as we turn inward for Yom Kippur. Thanks, Guy. Again, Gmar Tov, an easy fast, and we will talk next week.
Gmar Chatima Tova, thank you very much.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, from Two Jewish Storyteller Jordan Hill, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the outstanding restaurateur, Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant, the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Janos has been such a splendid restaurant now for a number of years. Not too many other places to go for that kind of meal, are there?
You know, less and less options all the time. That's one of the things that I'm proudest about. Great food, exquisitely prepared, terrific service, really personal. That's what we do. We prepare the best and bring it to you here in Tucson.
It's really fine dining, but with a special Southwestern local flavor.
Fine dining, Southwestern flavor, and really personal.
So if you want a special meal for yourselves, for guests, for anyone, what's the number to call, Janos?
615-6100. The website, janos.com. I know you like this, Rabbi. You can follow us on Facebook, too.
Thanks, Janos. I will look forward to seeing you there and anyone else who wants a great dining experience.
Rabbi, thank you.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom. Shana Tova.
Shana Tova to you and your listeners as well.
Thank you. You are going to be leading a trip to India in the not-too-distant future, a very interesting Jewish community and a very interesting country today. Let's start with a bit of the history. Indian Jewish community probably goes back to First Temple times, or the destruction of the First Temple anyway. There have been some Jews in India for a very long time, not that many, but in diverse places, different populations.
Right. Well, it's true that one of the many hats I wear is serving sometimes as a faculty host for trips organized by the University of Arizona Alumni Association to various places in the world. And usually I only volunteer to do this for countries I know about, have lived in, have worked in, whatever, where I really feel I can add something of value. In this particular case, there's a trip to India that was so oversubscribed, we had to divide it into two groups. And unfortunately, I can only accompany one of the two groups.
It is tragic, really.
Right. And they will soon have a briefing from me covering some of these same points. So I hope that not too many of them are listening to this broadcast. But in any case,
if you are, cover your ears.
You're absolutely right that some of the Jewish communities in India began with the first diaspora from Israel under the Persians, really. But the main Jewish communities in Israel...
In India, right.
Didn't necessarily come directly from Israel as a result of the destruction of either temple, but came rather as the agents of imperial expansion of the Persians, various groups of Turkic-speaking peoples, although not necessarily Turks from Turkey, and most importantly, with the big Arab expansion in the 7th and 8th centuries. You know, people who listen to CNN a lot think that Indonesia is the biggest Muslim country in the world, but in fact, India has more Muslims than Indonesia. India probably has 300 million Muslims, which is more than the total population of Indonesia, which is not all Muslim. But in the process of being ruled by a series of different groups of Muslims, lots of Jews settled in with these newly arrived Muslim armies in the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th centuries, and then more waves of Jews with the Mughals, and even more with the Brits in the 18th and 19th centuries. So Jews were all over India in different levels of civilization as traders, as doctors, as administrators, whatever, and both Ashkenazic Jews and Jews from the Eidot HaMizrach, the so-called Oriental Jews, and this one subgroup called B'nai Israel, who actually look like Indians because they've been there so long and there's been so much intermarriage that physically you can't really tell the difference. I think none of the communities in India has ever been hugely significant numerically, but geographically they've been all over the subcontinent. And it's important to realize, most people don't, that India is not so much a country as a construct. It's a whole continent. And there are lots of different languages, different alphabets, different religions. People look different in the north from the south. The differences are probably bigger than the differences between Finns and Greeks or between Irish and Portuguese. And one of the few ethnic groups that has helped to tie all of India together has been the Jews of India.
Interesting. Well, we'll continue this next week and explore a little bit about India and its relationship with Israel today. Very interesting subject when we come back next week.
I look forward to that.
Thanks, Tom. And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service for the high holy day season. Abe has a pet parrot he likes. In fact, it's such a smart parrot, he teaches him how to daven, how to pray, and pretty soon the parrot is chanting the liturgy of the morning service beautifully. Abe decides to teach the parrot how to chant the prayers for the high holy days from the Machzor. So the parrot learns to sing everything, both Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, perfectly. In fact, it actually becomes something of a pest, singing Amen again and again, high holy day melodies all the time. At daily minyan services one day, Abe brags to his friends about his parrot, how it chants services so magnificently. And his friends don't believe him. Sure, your parrot can chant Hineni. Oh, yeah. Your parrot's a cantor, right? A parrot chazan. They ridicule him mercilessly until finally Abe bets every one of them the parrot will indeed chant services. Thousands of dollars are wagered. The day of Rosh Hashanah arrives. Abe brings his parrot to temple, sets him up on the bima in front of the congregation, and says, okay, parrot, do your stuff. And nothing happens. Not a sound comes out of the parrot's mouth. Abe jiggles the bird, cajoles it. Come on, parrot, sing already. Tries to bribe it with apples dipped in honey. Finally, Abe starts to threaten the parrot. But nothing works. The parrot remains silent. Finally, in abject humiliation, Abe takes his parrot, bright red, and leaves the shul in shame, with the catcalls of his friends ringing in his ears. On the way home, Abe gives the parrot what for. You miserable, flea-ridden bag of feathers. I'll murder you. No, I'll fricassee you alive. I'll turn you into minced parrot. How could you humiliate me like that? And the parrot says, shush, still. What are you worried about? Think about the odds we'll get on Yom Kippur. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. You should live and be well. We welcome our Too Jewish storyteller, Jordan Hill. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Rabbi. So now we're here in the midst of Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur on either side of us. And so another story collected by Howard Schwartz on atonement. There was once this girl who lived ages and ages and ages ago, and she used to love more than anything else to sit under a tree as the sun set at night and to watch the stars come out. And her favorite thing of all was when she would see stars shooting across the sky. She used to dream of finding a shooting star for herself. When one night, as she was sitting there, she saw this flash in the sky. She looked up, expecting just to see the normal shooting star. And while she saw that streak, it seemed to be coming closer and closer. It didn't die out until suddenly, whew, there was this flash of light. And when she looked up, as her eyes adjusted, she saw this glowing light up in the tree. And quickly she climbed into the branches and, touching it to make sure it wasn't hot, she picked up this thing that was glowing and brought it down. And she saw that it was the most beautiful jewel with this light burning inside. And as she watched that dancing light, a face materialized. And the face claimed to be an archangel and told her that this was one of the 10 jewels that were in the very throne of heaven. It had fallen. And it was her job to bring it back. And she alone had to do it. No one could help her. Not demon, nor even angel could be trusted to avoid the temptation of this jewel. And just then, the light dimmed down. A cloud cut across the moon. And when the moonlight emerged once more, she heard a voice. And she spun. And there was a demon offering to take the jewel off her hands. But when she looked at that demon and asked him, "Where's your shadow?" he tried to see it, but we all know, of course, demons have no shadows. And so he started chasing himself in circles and circles and poof! Burst into smoke. And she was just getting ready to figure out how to get this to heaven when there was this flash of light and standing before her was the most beautiful, radiant being she had ever seen, clearly an angel. And he said, "It is not right for a young girl to have such responsibility. give me the jewel, I will return it to heaven. And she was tempted, but she remembered the archangel's words and she didn't trust him. Instead, she said, okay, I'll give you the jewel if you let me take a little spin with your wings. I've always wanted to fly. And so he removed his wings and handed them to her. But no sooner did she have them than she placed them on her shoulders and shot up into the sky with the jewel in her hand, away from that angel. She made her way all the way up to the very gates of heaven, which during the time preceding Yom Kippur are open, they say. And she passed through them, past huge choirs of singing angels, all the way to the highest of the highs, to the throne of God itself. And there was that one gap left empty, with those 9 other jewels still in place. And she took the jewel and placed it where it needed to be. And all of heaven burst into chorus, and this voice erupted from inside of her that said, you have given a gift to the world. You will be a gift to the world. And that voice burst into light from her heart. And there she remains up in the heavens to this very day, shining bright. We call her the morning star sometimes, and there she remains.
Thanks, Jordan. We'll get another story next week. And now a word of Torah. This week, Shabbat is more than just Sabbath. It is Shabbat Shabbaton, the great Sabbath of Sabbaths, Yom Kippur. We have 2 Torah readings on Yom Kippur, one in the morning and one during the afternoon service. And while atypically for Judaism, we all agree on what portion of the Torah is read for almost every ritual occasion, on Yom Kippur there is a significant difference of opinion, really different choices as to what Torah section will be read. Orthodox and conservative congregations on the morning of Yom Kippur this Saturday will read a description of the rites of sacrificing animals on the Day of Atonement from the time when the temple stood in Jerusalem. That'll be followed by the obscure and interesting ritual of the scapegoat. The scapegoat is a term that has become part of our regular English lexicon, but it was a real live goat in the days of the Torah. At the time of Yom Kippur, the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, in the course of preparing burnt offerings to put on the altar in the temple in Jerusalem, would select 2 goats. One was marked for God, the other for Azazel, a kind of code name for that which is unholy. Later, that came to represent the devil in other traditions. The goat marked for God, like the bull and other animals designated for ritual sacrifice, would be slaughtered and roasted on the altar, a normal procedure in those days. But the goat marked for Azazel had a different career ahead. Instead of being sacrificed in the ordinary way to expiate the sins of the people and seek forgiveness, the Azazel, the scapegoat, would be instead led out into the Judean desert, which is not far from Jerusalem. You can look out east and see it there. And then, from a mountaintop, the ritual would continue. The high priest would place his hand on the goat and symbolically transfer the many sins of the people onto the goat. And the goat, uninjured other than by the moral weight transferred to its horny head, would be set free to wander in the wilderness. The scapegoat, through no fault of its own, would carry the sins of the Israelites out of the land, but it itself would remain unharmed, an enduring symbol of the errors of our people. The term scapegoat, of course, has remained with us as a representation of the poor schnook tossed out by more powerful higher-ups to take the fall for their own sins. We still have scapegoats today, of course. Every staffer sacrificed on behalf of his political superior is a kind of fulfillment of this scapegoat routine. So why do we have this ritual in the Torah? The message is obscure. While the essence of Yom Kippur is the concept of personal responsibility, the scapegoat implies that even on a day dedicated to self-examination and atonement, it really helps to know that some sins may be passed off on a lesser creature. Or perhaps the idea is simply that we need to know that there is some ritual that can release us from our failures, even though we know that we will remain always fallible and human, even after Yom Kippur. The Torah readings in the Reformed Jewish tradition, which nearly always are close to the traditional ones, are not so on Yom Kippur. I believe, in this case, it's superior. In the morning of Yom Kippur, we will chant the great Torah portion of Nitzavim, Atem Nitzavim Hayom Kulchem. You stand here today, all of you, richest to poorest, most exalted to most humble, and the Lord your God presents you with a great and sacred choice. You can either choose to follow mitzvot, to live a life of morality and dedication to ethics and goodness, or sin again and stray from God. That choice is really between spiritual life and spiritual death. But the choice is always yours to make. Choose life, uvachart av chayim, that you and your children may live long and flourish. Take responsibility and choose life. A great message on the holiest day. When we come back on Two Jewish in a few moments, we'll find out from our guest, Aliza Levy, what's unique about women's prayer when we return on Two Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israeli and Palestinian leaders will meet every 2 weeks to advance peace talks. George Mitchell, the senior U.S. envoy, said the sides agreed to meet in the region September 14th to 15th, that's back in the Middle East, the first concrete outcome of the renewed talks launched last week in Washington. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas met with Mitchell and the U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton before moving into face-to-face talks. In this first stage, Mitchell said the sides would work towards a framework agreement ahead of a comprehensive agreement, which the U.S. wants to see within a year. That is, first a framework and then some general agreement. The parties themselves agreed that the logical way to succeed to tackle this is to reach a framework agreement first, Mitchell said. It's less than a full-fledged treaty. Purpose is to establish compromises necessary to enable an agreement and then flesh out the issues. Netanyahu suggested that he does not want to make substantial concessions until an agreement is in place and security mechanisms exist to protect Israel from rocket attacks and terror. In other news, billionaire Jewish philanthropist George Soros, who has played a huge part in the revival of democracy and freedom of expression and ideas in Eastern Europe and elsewhere, will give Human Rights Watch $100 million to expand its work throughout the world. The gift, announced last week, is the largest ever by Soros and the largest ever received by Human Rights Watch. Soros was born in Budapest in 1930 and grew up in Hungary during World War II. He survived the Nazis and the Battle of Budapest between the Nazis and the Soviets, and eventually made his way to England after the war. He became enormously wealthy, primarily through currency trading. Soros, who is 80, said the gift is the first of a series of huge gifts he plans to make. This year, Soros has donated some $700 million to several causes. However, he earned $3.3 billion from his hedge fund last year. Human Rights Watch, we just had their Middle East director, Bill Van Esvelt, on Two Jewish last month, monitors human rights abuses around the world. It has said it will add about 120 new staff members to its current 300 posted in capitals around the world, open new offices, and expand its translation of the approximately 100 reports a year it produces. Human Rights Watch is funded solely by private donations and now by a big one from George Soros. And sometimes in this strange world, intelligence support comes from odd places. Proving that there are major differences even between authoritarian leaders, Cuban dictator Fidel Castro criticized Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad for denying the Holocaust and promoting anti-Semitism. In an interview with Atlantic reporter Jeffrey Goldberg, Castro, a frequent critic of Israel, said the Iranian government could encourage peace by acknowledging the unique history of anti-Semitism and trying to understand why Israelis fear for their own existence. I think their culture and religion kept them together as a nation, Castro said of the Jewish people, adding that the Jews have lived an existence that is much harder than ours. There is nothing that compares to the Holocaust. Castro described his experiences with anti-Semitism as a young boy, when he was taught that the Jews killed God. Castro said he does not believe Iran will back down on its pursuit of nuclear weapons despite sanctions and threats of an Israeli attack. The problem is not going to get resolved because the Iranians are not going to back down in the face of threats, Castro said. The Iranian capacity to inflict damage is not appreciated. Men think they can control themselves, but Obama could overreact and a gradual escalation could become a nuclear war, which everybody agrees would be, you know, bad. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Dr. Lisa Levie, visiting with us from Israel. She is the editor, author of A Jewish Woman's Prayer Book, which won the National Jewish Book Award last year. It's called In Hebrew Tfilat Nashim, and it has become, which is unusual for a prayer book, really a bestseller. It has certainly become an influential piece. That is far from the only thing to tell you about Dr. Lisa Levie. She's a lecturer in the Department of Political Studies at Bar-Ilan University in the Tel Aviv area. In addition to being an academic, she's been a writer, publicist, media personality, newscaster, lots of different things. So is this like a natural career arc? She's a mother, an IDF officer in the past, a teacher of various places. Do you see this as sort of a culmination of your work, this Woman's Prayer Book, or just sort of another interest?
It's a very good question because, you know, my colleagues here in the university and even my husband asked me, Lisa, what are you doing? I mean, what is it all about? And, you know, sometimes in life you feel that you can't. I mean, you have to do something, you know. I mean, 7 years ago when I started with everything, it was a bad time here in Israel, a lot of bombs around, and you start your day and you didn't know what will be in the end of the day. You say hello to the kids, and I mean, it was really bad days here. And I remember that I read an article together with it was an interview in the newspaper with Chen Kenan. She lost her baby and her mother in a terror attack in a very small mall here in Israel. It was in Petah Tikva. And actually, when I read this interview with her, it was 2 weeks after she left Israel, and she moved to the States together with her husband. And she said in this interview, from my understanding, it was a goodbye letter to the Israeli society. And she said that she can't stay here anymore here in Israel. And as I said, it was a goodbye letter to the Israeli society. And when I read it, I mean, I found myself, you know, want to speak with her and wanted to hug her. I want to tell her about other women in the Jewish history, women that have rights and you know, they have ability to speak with the Creator. And I couldn't find her. And more than that, when I spoke with the journalist who interviewed her, she told me, Lisa, leave her. She doesn't want to speak with anyone from Israel. And I together with my question that I told you before, and with this pain, with this wanted to hug her, I tried to find an answer, and I spent 3 years in archives, university museum. I spoke with old ladies and men and asked them about, you know, their parents and their communities and their behaviors and customs, and I found that a lot of this are not in the university, in the books, because
they're not in the Sidurim, you mean?
And not in the room, because we're talking about oral prayers, prayers that go from a mother to daughter. And don't forget what's happened, I mean, in our history. I remember the first phone call after the book was published here in Israel. It was from a rabbi from Me'asharim. Me'asharim is the ultra-Orthodox neighborhood in Jerusalem. And she called me the other day and asked me to come and give a lecture. So I said, I don't believe that you called me. And she said, me either. But she told me, you know, the book was published without approval. because I thought it, you know, I don't need approval for...
Let me explain just a moment. Approval is rabbinical approval. In other words, the rabbis have to give sort of a heksher, a stamp in the front of most prayer books in Israel to be widely accepted in the Orthodox
world. We call it haskama, yeah.
Right.
And I felt, you know, I don't need a approval, a rabbinical, you know, kosher sign for them, for women prayers. And to be honest with you, I didn't think about ultra-Orthodox people, you know. And she told me that the ladies in her community found the book and they couldn't buy it because there is no approval. But then they found... Trina's prayers that they were familiar with them, but they didn't know exactly the prayers, because this lady came from the Belz Hasidut. It's a very unique Hasidut, but most of this Hasidut were killed in Auschwitz, and was killed in Auschwitz, and you know, only the memories and the words, you know, they remember them. And now when they saw the prayers in the book, they found it. I mean, oh, we're familiar with it. Even it's broken words, but we're familiar with this music, with this prayers. This prayer was belonged to our grandmother, etc., etc. And she asked me to come and give all the lecture, because in our days, this community tried to build again the history, the oral tradition that they lost in the Holocaust. And a lot of stories like this I found. Actually, after the book was published, here and after in the States, it was a totally different story. But after the book was published here in Israel, so many emails and letters and people came to me and gave me a lot of information and prayers about you know, women that I weren't familiar. I wasn't familiar with women that wrote amazing prayers, but no information about them in the encyclopedia, in the lexicon, etc., etc. And yeah, a lot of questions to ask.
It's a remarkable recovery of what people would say were lost women's prayer voices, you know, the prayers that were go back throughout history. You know, and I'm familiar with some old Yiddish women's prayer books, Tzenor, Anna. There were such things sometimes in the Ashkenazic world, but not as much in other parts of the Jewish world, and probably many were lost too.
Yeah, actually, the oldest prayer that I found was published in the 13th century in north of Italy. Mm. And yeah.
If you had to pick one prayer as your favorite prayer that you discovered, which would it be?
Oh, it's not fair, you know. It's like to ask a mother.
Which is your favorite child?
I think that my favorite one is for a mother that her son goes to the army. And when I, you know, I you can't find a lot of information about Fanny Noida. And I, 2 years ago, I went to Czech Republic, and I went to her small, neglected village. It was, you know, 3 hours by train from Prague. Very small, yeah. And I thought maybe I go to this village. And in Hebrew we said, in the end of the war, turn left. So this is the place of the village. And I went there. And I found the synagogue, but the Nazis destroyed all the synagogue, almost all the synagogue. But, you know, when I went inside and I prayed this special prayer in Hebrew, I told Fanny, I mean, I don't know if you know, but you're amazing prayer are so popular in Israel, and I think that you even dream that ladies will say it in Hebrew and in English, because we translate also for to English.
I want to thank Dr. Lisa Levy for a great visit on Too Jewish. The book is called A Jewish Woman's Prayer Book. You can find it online, Tfilat Nashim. Thank you for a wonderful interview and for doing such remarkable work.
And thank you. And you work very hard to translate and to make the right adaptation to the, you know, to English. It was a missing for us, and I hope that people will, you know, find themselves in the book.
Thank you. I think they will. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community.
Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be legendary sportscaster Len Berman. Our playout this morning comes from Cantor and Broadway star and former Too Jewish guest David Fisher. Shana Tova. Have a good year. My friends, have an easy fast on Yom Kippur and Gemar Chatima Tova. May you be sealed in the Book of Life for a good year and have a Lashana Tova, a year of blessing and health. And of course, a Shavua Tov. A week, we pray, of peace.
Shana Tova, Shana Tova, Vanava Rabba Hinekreva, Avislicha, Dam Ahava, Avipius, Vegam.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.